This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, and welcome back to The New Scientist. I'll be reading from the Saturday, January 6th edition today, starting off with an article from Biotechnology. Set a virus to catch a virus. A virus engineered using CRISPR technology spread its DNA to other viruses in a mouse study, which could be used to make pathogens harmless. A virus genetically engineered to spread its DNA to other viruses via CRISPR gene editing has done exactly that in tests in mice. The hope is that these viruses could alter others, such as herpes, in a way that prevents them from causing symptoms. It's a new technology, says Marius Walter at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington. Can we bring it to people? That's a long way ahead. We have a lot of work to do, but I think this is an exciting technology. This approach is known as a gene drive, when a bit of DNA somehow manages to get passed down to a higher proportion of offspring than normal. This means gene drives can spread through a population even if they are disadvantageous. In the past century, scientists have discovered many natural gene drives that work via a wide variety of mechanisms. Then, in 2014, Kevin Esvelt at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his colleagues outlined how CRISPR gene editing could be used to create powerful artificial gene drives. By 2018, CRISPR gene drives were working in caged mosquitoes with the aim of stopping the spread of malaria. In animals that reproduce sexually, CRISPR gene drives work by copying and pasting themselves from one chromosome to another, meaning they end up in all eggs or all sperm, and therefore all offspring, instead of half, as would usually be the case. A virus doesn't reproduce sexually. Instead, it replicates by getting the cell it infects to make lots of copies of it too. So the assumption was that gene drives couldn't work in viruses. But cells are sometimes infected by more than one type of virus at a time, and Walter realized that such co-infections provide an opportunity for gene drives to work. If a gene drive carrying virus infects a cell at the same time as a normal virus, the gene drive can copy and paste itself into the DNA of all the new viruses being made. If further co-infections keep happening, eventually all the viruses causing an infection inside an individual will carry the gene drive. I got this idea of, oh, let's try to make a gene drive, says Walter. At that point, it was a bit of a crazy idea, but we ended up making it work. In 2020, his team reported that a viral gene drive can work in human cells growing in a dish. When cytomegaloviruses with and without a gene drive were introduced, the gene drive spread until it was carried by more than 95% of the viruses. The reaction to most biologists to the paper was that viral gene drives wouldn't work during a real infection because they thought co-infections were much rarer in bodies than in cells in a dish. To prove the skeptics wrong, Walter's team infected mice with herpes simplex type 1 viruses, in which 15% of the viruses carried a gene drive. After 4 days, the proportion of viruses with the gene drive had risen to between 60 and 90%. This shows that viral gene drives can work in animals. However, there are limitations. For instance, the approach will work only with DNA viruses, not RNA ones, such as flu and the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, because, among other things, RNA viruses are typically too small to carry a gene drive. The approach will also probably be most useful for treating persistent infections, for instance, in people with weakened immune systems, or latent infections, where viruses lie dormant in cells and occasionally reactivate, as happens with herpes. With infections that last only a week or two, using a gene drive probably wouldn't help much by the time someone is diagnosed. If, however, a gene drive were allowed to spread from individual to individual, this could make all the viruses circulating in a population less dangerous, but Walter neither aims to do this nor thinks it would ever be allowed. He's now testing ways of using viral gene drives to stop dormant herpes viruses from reactivating and causing symptoms. But regulators may be reluctant to approve treatments designed to spread DNA, even to treat individuals. Existing live vaccines sometimes pass pathogens to non-vaccinated people, and the risk would be greater with gene drive carrying viruses. The issue of unwanted transmission to other individuals would need careful investigation, says Esvelt. This would be hardest to prevent with viruses that can cause latent infections, he says. As far as current medical ethics is concerned, that would be a non-starter. Yet even if viral gene drives are never used to treat people, they could still teach us a lot, says Walter. The fact that we're seeing such a high level of co-infection tells us about the way the herpes virus spreads naturally, he says. We're developing the technology, but also discovering some interesting biology. Now over to zoology. Monkeys in Thailand took up stone tools when COVID-19 stopped tourism. Wild monkeys began using stone tools for the first time on a Thai island amid the coronavirus pandemic, when travel restrictions meant they were no longer being fed by tourists. Several groups of primates use stone tools, but we haven't been able to study the origins of this behavior before, says Jonathan Reeves at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. We can observe it and we get to see it, but seldom do we get the chance to see it emerge as a new behavior. The monkeys in question are common long-tailed macaques. Hundreds of them live on Koh Phed, a small island close to the city of Pattaya. Tourists visiting the city often take a boat to the island and feed the monkeys mangoes, cucumbers, and nuts. Researchers led by Suchinda Mylavitnod at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, Thailand, have been visiting the Koh Phed macaques for a decade. They never saw them use stone tools before 2020. Then came the COVID-19 pandemic. Tourists didn't visit because of travel restrictions, and nor could the researchers. When they finally returned in July 2022, they saw two adult male monkeys using pebbles to break open oyster shells. On a follow-up visit in March 2023, the team systematically looked for tool use and saw 17 monkeys using stones to crack open oysters. They did so in a clumsy way. The monkey would lift a rock in both hands to about shoulder height, then throw it at the oyster bed. When we think about the broader diversity of primates, stone tool use is really rare, says Reeves, who wasn't involved in the study. Previously, five populations were known to use stone tools. Chimpanzees, bearded capuchins, yellow-breasted capuchins, white-faced capuchins, and Burmese long-tailed macaques, which are closely related to the Koh Phed monkeys. In fact, a 2018 experiment on captive M. fascialaris M. fascialaris, the Koh Phed macaques, found that they failed to learn to use stone tools, despite being given training. The implication was that they didn't have the capacity to do so. However, the new data on wild macaques suggests the issue is incentive, says Reeves. The animals had experienced 2 years of food shortages, giving them a strong motivation to innovate. The researchers say the monkeys they saw using stone tools were typically foraging alone. Reeves says it would be good to follow up and see when different individuals start using tools and who they associate with, to see if social learning is involved or if it is about individual creativity. However, tourists are again visiting Koh Phed and feeding the macaques. Mylavitnod's team says this might cause the monkeys to stop using stone tools, dashing further studies of this behavior. Now over to astronomy. Radio bursts from space exhibit sad trombone effect. Short, powerful bursts of radio waves from space are getting stranger and stranger. Astronomers have spotted 35 of these bursts from a single object with a pattern unlike any we have ever seen before. Sophia Sheikh at the SETI University in California and her colleagues observed this object, a fast radio burst called FRB 20220912A. For 541 hours using the Allen Telescope Array in California. In each of the bursts from this FRB, they saw a phenomenon called the sad trombone effect, where the frequency of the radio waves drops over the course of the burst. The sad trombone effect has been seen before, but the bursts from this FRB also displayed a new pattern. Over time, the frequency and bandwidth of the bursts dropped with respect to the ones before. The sad trombone effect is a burst-by-burst effect. You can see it if you look at a single burst. But then in these sets of bursts, the frequency also appears to be decreasing, says team member Will Farah, also at the SETI Institute. It's like a long, sad trombone effect, a trombone that is being saddened over a really long period of time. It isn't clear what could explain this elongated drop-off, especially because the cause of FRBs remains unknown. One leading idea is that these bursts come from magnetars, which are spinning, highly magnetized neutron stars. But no model has been able to account for all the behaviors of all the FRBs that have been observed. My understanding is that no one has really checked if the current magnetar models could explain the frequency decrease that we see, because it had never been observed before, says Sheikh. This FRB's behavior is still relatively consistent with magnetars. The question is which subclass of magnetar models will be able to explain this behavior. Now over to mental health. Home use headset eases depression. Brain zapping device relieves symptoms as well as antidepressants do. Using a headset at home to deliver a low electrical current to the brain can relieve symptoms of depression. The approach, called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS, is effective when used several times a week for half an hour at a time. Previous trials have shown that the therapy works under medical supervision in a clinic or lab. Now, a randomized trial has demonstrated that a TDCS headset can also reduce depression symptoms when worn at home. Depression is usually treated with talking therapies or by taking antidepressant medicines, but these don't help everyone. Several forms of electrical brain stimulation may have the potential to treat depression. With TDCS, sponge electrodes are placed on the left and right sides of the forehead, causing a mild current to flow from the left to the right. This makes brain cells on the left side more likely to fire, with some studies suggesting that activity in this region, known as the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, is low in people with depression. Repeated sessions of stimulation may lead to longer-term changes in the brain cells, increasing their activity levels, says team member Cynthia Fu at the University of East London. Affecting activity in this region probably changes activity in multiple areas, she says. There are probably many brain regions underlying depression. To see if people can benefit from using such a device at home, Fu and her colleagues tested a TDCS headset made by Swedish firm Flow Neuroscience. The firm sponsored the study, but had no role in data analysis, interpretation of data, decision to publish, or manuscript preparation, the researchers write in their paper. The team randomly assigned 174 people with moderate or severe depression to receive either a full session of stimulation from the Flow headset or stimulation from the same device that lasted just a few seconds, so people felt their skin tingling at the start and end of each session. They were shown how to use the headset at home alone for all 10 weeks via an online video call. While the depression symptoms of both groups improved on a 52-point scale, those who got the real treatment showed the most benefit by about 9 points compared to 7, a degree of difference that is similar to that seen with depressants. We found people liked having it at home, says Fu. Participants could build it into their day. Those who got the real stimulation were more likely to report skin redness and irritation, however, and 2 people experienced burns from using sponges that had dried out. The results may get such headsets taken more seriously by doctors, says Nick Davis at Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK. This feels really positive, he says. Now over to food science. Microbes identified that give cheddar its distinct flavor. The nutty, creamy flavor of cheddar cheese varies according to a delicate balance of bacteria, which has now been identified. Understanding these bacterial interactions could help cheesemakers achieve specific flavors. All fermented food and drinks, including cheese, kimchi, and kombucha, rely on interactions between microorganisms. To make cheese, starter cultures are added to milk to kickstart fermentation and acidify the product, leading to a slightly tangy taste. Cheesemakers have long understood that some of the key bacteria involved in this process are Streptococcus thermophilus and types of Lactococcus, but little is known about how these interact and if those interactions influence the cheese flavor. Trats Malkonian at Utrecht University in the Netherlands and his team have now made cheddar cheese using 4 starter cultures. One came from industrial producers and contained Streptococcus thermophilus and types of Lactococcus, mainly Lactococcus lactis and its subspecies Lactococcus cremoris. The others were made by the researchers and contained either the same bacteria as before, no Streptococcus thermophilus, or no Lactococcus. 1 year later, the team found the cheese made from the starter without Streptococcus thermophilus had much lower populations of types of Lactococcus than the others. Even the cheese made using a starter without any Lactococcus types to start off with. This suggests Streptococcus thermophilus is important in enhancing Lactococcus growth, says Malkonian. When it comes to flavor, Lactococcus cremoris seems to regulate the development of the chemicals diacetyl and acetoin, which can provide a buttery flavor but can lead to an off taste in high volumes. Lactococcus cremoris also increased the concentration of compounds that add subtle meaty and fruity notes, say the researchers. In the absence of this subspecies, the cheeses tended to have higher levels of chemicals that add hints of nutty and creamy flavors. The findings could help cheesemakers tweak their products or inform computer simulations that could formulate a starter with certain bacterial proportions for a desired flavor, says Malkonian. Now over to space. Dead satellites seed upper atmosphere with bits of metal. When satellites reach the end of their lives, they fall into Earth's atmosphere and burn up. This is generally considered harmless, but as more satellites are launched and eventually deorbited, it could begin to affect the climate. Daniel Murphy at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Chemical Sciences Laboratory and his colleagues used a particle analysis by laser mass spectrometry, or PALMS, instrument to study hundreds of thousands of atmospheric particles above Alaska. The PALMS instrument sits in a high-altitude aircraft and uses lasers to measure particulate matter. There are 2 main sources of metals in the atmosphere: meteoroids and satellites. Remains tend to contain aluminium and other elements and compounds that aren't formed naturally on meteoroids. About half of the particles in the stratosphere have metal in them, and the researchers found that about 1/5 of those particles seem to come from satellites and other spacecraft. About 10% of the particles in the stratosphere contain aluminum alloys from spacecraft, and that's an extraordinary number, Murphy told a recent meeting of the American Geophysical Union in California. While this probably isn't enough to meaningfully affect the stratosphere, there are plans to increase satellite numbers. Ice forming in the atmosphere tends to begin around solid particles in a process called nucleation, leading to clouds. And the way these metals affect other particles in the atmosphere could boost that process. We don't know anything definite yet, but ice nucleation may be one of the major impacts, said Murphy. Stratospheric clouds can destroy ozone molecules in the polar region, so seeding more clouds could be a big problem. Now over to neuroscience. People's speed of sight varies, and this may explain sporting prowess. Some people see fast-moving objects more clearly, while others miss them. Our ability to perceive rapid changes in visual scenes over time, our speed of sight, varies a surprising amount between people, according to the first study to systematically investigate the question. This suggests that some people can track fast-moving objects better than others because of their innate superior vision, which may contribute to people's different abilities in sports like baseball and cricket, says Clinton Harlem at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. Our speed of sight is also known as the flicker fusion threshold, because if a light is flashing on and off at a frequency above someone's threshold, it appears to them to be shining steadily. It's comparable to how many frames per second our visual system processes, says Harlem. This threshold varies widely in the animal kingdom, being higher in creatures that can move faster, especially if they hunt other speedy animals. For instance, the peregrine falcon, the fastest creature on Earth thanks to its plummeting hunting dives, has a flicker fusion frequency of about 130 images per second, or 130 hertz. The upper threshold for humans is often taken as a flicker rate of about 60 hertz. To find out how much this ability varies between individuals, Harlem and his colleagues asked 88 people from the university to view a flickering light, the frequency of which could be adjusted. They used three methods, asking each person to turn the frequency up until the light stopped flickering them, asking them to turn the frequency down until flickering began, or asking them to say whether the light was flickering over a series of randomly chosen frequencies. The participants repeated all the tests on three occasions to see if their threshold changed from day to day. Using the last method, thought to be the most accurate, the average flicker threshold for the whole group was about 50 hertz, but it varied from 34 to 61 hertz. The range is a lot larger than I expected, says team member Kevin, also at Trinity College Dublin. For most things in the world, that probably wouldn't make any difference to the way they're perceived because they're not moving fast enough. But there are some things moving very fast where it might well make a difference. If something were to fly past your eyes very rapidly, but you have a threshold high enough to capture the image, your brain would probably turn it into a blur going in a certain direction, says Harlem. Whereas in someone with a very low threshold, that flying object might not be captured at all. It isn't known what causes people's flicker threshold to vary, but it could involve innate features of parts of the brain that process vision, or of the cells at the back of the eye that react to light. There are multiple levels of processing that get an image presented to our conscious perception, says Harlem. I think it's a combination. This is a very nice study because it's completely new, says biologist Simon Poitier. He speculates that people might be able to increase their flicker threshold with training, for instance, if they play a lot of sports involving fast-moving balls, such as squash or baseball. Now to marine biology, a harmless way to keep sharks away from beaches. Great white sharks avoid places where they've been caught, which might give us a way of deterring them from hunting near swimmers. It's a flight response, says Paul Butcher at the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries in Australia. It's the same with almost any animal and the same with sharks. The animals later resume their normal migratory movements as if nothing ever happened, he says. Butcher and his colleagues have been using SMART, Shark Management Alert in Real Time, drum lines, baited hooks on buoys located 500 meters off the coast of about 20 popular areas in New South Wales. Each of the 305 total drum lines is equipped with a system that notifies local response teams who aim to reach any hook shark by boat within 30 minutes of the animal taking the bait. The lines are set anew each morning and collected later that day so they aren't left overnight. The teams record the shark's size and health and tag it. They then move sharks deemed as more of a threat to swimmers, great white, tiger, and bull sharks, another 500 meters offshore and let them go. Other species, such as hammerhead and gray nurse sharks, are released where caught. Butcher and his colleagues monitored 36 great white sharks, that were equipped with dorsal fin-mounted satellite-linked radio transmitting tags after being caught at 5 sites in 2016. During the first 3 days after the shark's release, they all moved away from the beaches where they had been caught and stayed mostly offshore. Although sharks gradually moved closer to the shore 10 days after release, 77% of the sharks remained more than 1.9 kilometers away from the coast and an average of 5 kilometers away from where they were tagged, wrote the researchers in their paper. In addition, the sharks were still being detected via the tracking equipment for an average of nearly 600 days after their release, showing that the program doesn't increase the risk of them dying. Since 2015, more than 1,100 great whites, with an average length of about 2.6 meters, have been caught on the smart drum lines, with more than 400 recapture events, says Butcher. The drum lines are part of a larger attempt in New South Wales to find non-lethal ways to keep great white, tiger, and bull sharks away from people in the water. Drones are now flown at up to 50 beaches to look out for sharks and other potential threats during school holidays, and the department runs 37 shark listening station buoys that detect when tagged target sharks pass nearby. This information is then sent to the public via the Shark Smart app. This suite of tools could one day mean that controversial beach meshing nets, which in New South Wales alone captured 228 animals in the 2022-23 reporting period, can be removed. Of these 228 animals, only 85 were released alive, and more than 200 were non-target species, including turtles, dolphins, and seals. David Booth at the University of Technology in Sydney says the study's findings are very good news, and to still be reciting the caught and released animals years later is pretty impressive, and certainly better than slaughtering them, he says. Now over to medicine. AI discovers new class of antibiotics to kill resistant bacteria. Artificial intelligence has helped discover a new class of antibiotics that can treat infections caused by drug-resistant bacteria. Our AI models tell us not only which compounds have selective antibiotic activity, but also why, says Felix Wong at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Wong and his colleagues tested the effects of more than 39,000 compounds on Staphylococcus aureus in 3 types of human cells from the liver, skeletal muscle, and lungs. The results became the training data for AI models to learn about the patterns in each compound's atoms and bonds that allowed the AIs to predict both antibacterial activity of such compounds and their potential toxicity to our cells. That's all for this week. Thank you for listening.